I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Today on the show, a disturbing chapter from American history, the government's secret recruitment of hundreds of Nazi scientists after World War II. Many of them came to Maryland. At Edgewood Arsenal, they worked side by side with American scientists to test German-developed nerve gas on unsuspecting U.S. soldiers. And they developed biological weapons at what became Fort Detrick, the Army's laboratories in Frederick. We'll hear about the covert Operation Paperclip in the second hour of today's show. Here in the first hour, Baltimore's Latino community is growing and changing. A Hopkins conference attempts to better understand it. Also, Maryland decides to be more discerning about its role in the deportation of undocumented immigrants. Midday Friday starts after the news from NPR. Hey, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. In the second hour of our show today, journalist Annie Jacobson joins us. Her new book is Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. And what an eye-opener this is, and what a piece of work that book is. It's a very extensive look at previously classified documents about this operation. We'll be talking about it in the second hour of our show today. The U.S. that secretly recruited estimated 1,600 Nazi scientists and covered up their past to prepare for what they thought was going to be a total war, Cold War Armageddon with the Soviets that never happened. And Annie Jacobson has disturbing new details about Operation Paperclip, about which there's been some reporting in the past, but there's some new information here, including information about what went on at Edgewood Arsenal and at Fort Detrick in Frederick, Maryland. So Annie Jacobson joining us for the second hour of our show today. Governor Martin O'Malley announced last week that the Baltimore City Detention Center will no longer automatically honor requests from the federal government to hold immigrants for deportation. The move is intended to reduce deportations of immigrants who do not have criminal records under a federal program called Secure Communities, which we've discussed here on Midday. That program is run by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. That's ICE, of course, ICE. It's supposed to identify repeat and violent offenders for deportation. But my colleague from the Baltimore Sun, John Fritzy, did some reporting on this, and his analysis found that more than 40% of those deported out of Maryland had no prior criminal record, far higher than the national average when it comes to that particular number. The move by the governor makes Maryland one of a few states to take a more discerning approach to its role in secure communities. So we're going to talk a little bit about this today. Liz Alex is with us, lead organizer for CASA Maryland here in Baltimore. She's been fighting for this for the last 4 years. So Liz, nice to have you back with us.
Thanks so much.
We should just start off talking a little bit about what secure communities is, what it's supposed to do, and how it functions in Maryland.
Sure. So the Secure Communities Program is a program of the federal government, as you mentioned, which has been forced upon our local and state governments. Actually, here in Baltimore, our city council and our mayor actively opposed it, but were told that they had no choice in 2012 when it was implemented here in Baltimore. And essentially what it is a data sharing program.
Data sharing.
So fingerprints, when you are booked to central booking, right, your fingerprints are taken. Those prints are sent to the FBI, and the FBI is sending them to immigration. Now, if immigration has any reason to suspect that they are interested in talking to you further as a potential immigration violator, they will send what is called a detainer request to the local jail. And that's where all of this, the governor's policy really takes effect. That is a request. It is not a mandate, and it is discretionary.
Yeah, so the governor is saying we're not going to automatically just hold people sometimes indefinitely for at least for long periods of time. We're going to be more discerning about who we hold?
Correct. So under sort of federal law, they're not allowed to hold anyone beyond 48 hours. That's the maximum limit that they can hold them once their criminal case has been dismissed. However, under the governor's policy, he's going to limit that even further and say, we're not going to hold anybody even 48 hours unless they meet one or more of a series of criteria.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that criteria a little bit. Because the premise here, the idea supposedly, by the way, this isn't law. This is an ICE policy, right?
The Secure Communities program.
It's program.
It's a program.
It's a program of ICE. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the idea was to ferret out violent people with criminal records, felons.
Correct.
Violent records. And if they if they're in the country illegally, deport them, right?
Correct. And that is actually a principle that I think has broad support, right? That if we have limited enforcement resources for immigration, we should target people who are threats to our public safety here in Maryland.
Okay. So the problem has been that people get picked up for what? Speeding, being drunk and disorderly, things like that, misdemeanors?
Yeah, I will say the vast majority of cases that we have seen have been triggered by traffic offenses, by very minor things that you or I may get a ticket for that are resulting in someone being arrested for driving without a license is sort of the most frequent one that we see. And those folks end up in jail. They get this detainer put on them by ICE. Mm-hmm. The jail would have otherwise just released them after they paid a fine, but instead they are holding them for a couple days.
What would happen to you and me if we were driving without a license?
We might get a ticket. We might get a court date. We might get a ticket. We might get arrested. Each police officer has some discretion in that matter.
Okay. But you're seeing people arrested and taken to BCDC.
Central booking.
Right? Mm-hmm. And central booking or in Baltimore County, Anne Arundel County. This is going on in every county in Maryland
exactly.
now, right?
Whatever the county jail is in the county.
And John Fritzi's analysis showed 40% of the folks who were deported or were held.
Who were transferred to ICE.
Turned over to the federal government. Mm-hmm. Had no criminal record at all previously.
Right. That's what his investigation has shown us.
Okay. And then there was another study done by Syracuse University. I noticed it was published. Immigrants initially taken into custody in Maryland spent an average of 80 days in detention compared to the national average of 31 days. That was research conducted by a group at Syracuse University, Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse. About 11% of immigrants picked up in Maryland spent more than 6 months detained, compared with a national average of 3%. So the governor looking at that saying, well, we've got to slow this thing down a little bit.
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot of regional variability in some of that. But what we have noticed, by and large, in this area, in Baltimore City, Baltimore County, we're seeing a lot of people picked up on very minor offenses, held in our local jails when they otherwise would have been released, transferred to immigration, sometimes spending a long time in immigration custody if they don't have the financial resources to post bond in their immigration case, and then ultimately many times deported. You know, we had a family that still strikes me because the young lady is about to graduate from high school. Her father, shortly after this program was activated, now this was in Baltimore County, but he was driving to pick up his nephew from preschool. He was driving and was stopped by the local police, asked for a license, did not have one, was arrested, and ultimately deported. And so she has been here, you know, growing up, going through high school without her father. She'll be graduating in a couple weeks.
In that story, do you know why he was stopped?
The reason that the officer says was he looked suspicious.
He looks suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There was no actual traffic violation other than driving.
Is this, by the way, is this far too common a thing, driving without a license among immigrants?
Well, with the new driver's license law, it is hopefully on the downhill.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because the legislature acted on that last year, right?
The legislature did act, and that new law allowing undocumented folks to get driver's license took effect just in January of this year. It is a process, so it's taking a while for people to get through the process. But I know our office is swamped with people coming in, trying to get through that process, making sure they file their taxes, making sure they meet all the requirements in order to get their driver's license.
This is a quote from Jessica Vaughn, who is with the Center for Immigration Studies based in Washington. They support tighter immigration controls. This is her reaction to what the governor did last week. She says, it has nothing to do with public safety and everything to do with obstructing enforcement of immigration laws. Marylanders should be outraged that Governor O'Malley has put the interests of immigration scoff laws ahead of their legitimate interest in having immigration laws enforced, which protects jobs and public safety. Now, I look at that and I say, well, actually, so what you're saying here is that Secure Communities, this program, is really about rounding up illegals, undocumented immigrants, and deporting them, whether or not they have a criminal past.
I mean, and that's what the data is showing us, right? The program was initially billed as targeting very violent, serious criminals. And in fact, the data in Maryland, but actually around the country, has shown completely the contrary, that it is actually just a mechanism to make it easier for ICE to deport a lot of people. And actually, you know, just this month under President Obama's administration, we're hitting 2 million people that have been deported under Obama, which is a record.
And some calling him, some of his allies, previous allies, people who have supported him, referring to him as deporter in chief because of what's going on there. You don't see any slowdown in that then?
Not to date. I mean, we see this program continues. The deportations continue, you know, as long as Congress fails to act and the president fails to put some kind of a block to this program and other similar programs that are resulting in record high deportations. Our families are going to continue to be divided. People are going to continue to be afraid to call the police if they continue to use our local police as the arm of ICE. So I think that's one reason that the governor's policy is going to be very helpful, I think, here locally. And that's why we gave it, when we were working on this in the state legislature, we called it the Trust Act, because we want to make sure that here in Baltimore, if you're a victim of a crime or you see criminal activity going on, you call the police without fear that somehow you're going to get rounded up, wind up in central booking, and wind up deported. We want, and our local electeds and our local police commissioner, Bats, agree with that. They want to make sure that everyone calls the police when they have a reason to call.
Liz, Alex is with CASA Maryland, based here in Baltimore. When these folks get arrested and they're taken into detention, according to this study, an average of 80 days in detention in Maryland, that's not just in Baltimore, but in Maryland, do they get any representation? Do they have any legal representation?
So immigrants, like everyone, have a legal right to representation in court. In criminal court, if they can't afford a lawyer, one is provided to them.
Okay, the public defender's office goes to work for them as well?
In the criminal system. In the immigration system, there is no similar free lawyer system. So if they cannot afford a lawyer once they're transferred to immigration, they don't have the one.
Okay, answer this question for me, Liz. If you get picked up for driving without a license or for speeding, whatever it is, they are drunk and disorderly, I don't know, and you're taken in, and they run these data check on you, and they find out, hey, you're not in the country, you don't have any papers, you know, you're in here in the country in an undocumented status. Is there anything to stop you from being deported?
So the president, in several years back, outlined around the same time that this program was being activated, he said, you know, there's a series of criteria. People that have, and it's a balancing act, right? People that have a lot of negative things on their side, like a criminal record or have just been arrested for a violent crime, those are people that we should be prioritizing. But we should not be prioritizing gentlemen like the dad of the young lady I was just mentioning, who have lots of family here who are U.S. citizens.
But he was deported.
And so, again, this is another situation where the sort of public statement of what should be happening is not matching what we're seeing on the ground. And that's here locally in Baltimore, but it's across the country. That's why next week, actually, on May 1st, which is International Workers' Day, we'll be heading to the White House to protest in front of the White House to tell President Obama that we need to stop the deportations.
As far as Maryland goes, and coming back to what Governor O'Malley announced last week, how are they going to implement that? How are they going to, you know, be more discerning about who they hold and for ICE?
So when the federal government sends that detainer request, it is actually a physical piece of paper, and they have to mark why they want that person held. So we're hopeful that we'll be able to work with the governor's office and with the, you know, the Department of Public Safety and Corrections to create a good system so that they're able to make sure that they're following the policy. And also, you know, we want to work with the governor to make sure that the criteria on his policy are sort of going to meet his intent. There are definitely policies around the country that are stronger than others. What would make me very nervous is a policy that would say folks that are charged with crimes, whatever the, you know, a serious crime, are automatically going to be sent to immigration. Because for me, the difference between charged and convicted is serious, and I don't want people to get charged with crimes that they did not commit just for the purpose of putting them.
And yet they're in that pipeline. They're already in the pipeline,
yeah,
even though there isn't a
conviction.
To me,
that's sort of an access to justice issue.
Right, right. Now, you keep your eye on what's going on in Washington. You mentioned President Obama and this protest that's being planned. There was some progress being made in the U.S. Senate, right, toward getting an agreement on immigration laws in America and what to do with, some 11, 12 million estimated undocumented folks here. But we don't go any further than that. It doesn't get through the House. I mean, did you see some progress being made, at least with what the Senate came up with?
Oh, I mean, the Senate bill passed. That was the end of last June.
Yeah.
And since then, we had high hopes that, you know, Speaker Boehner, Cantor, all the Republican leadership even had said, this is an important issue. We will address immigration reform this year. And yet, you know, the Republican Party is so divided in the House that even though there's a fair number of Republicans that say, yes, I would vote for a comprehensive immigration reform on the floor, the leadership is having a hard time wrangling their votes together to get that to happen. And they're, you know, we're not optimistic that the Republican Congress is going to be able to do that.
Liz Alex is lead organizer for CASA Maryland here in Baltimore. So thank you for that, Liz. We'll check back with you again another time to see how this is working out.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. This is Midday Friday. Dan Roderick's here. When we come back, more on immigrants, specifically Maryland's and Baltimore's growing and changing Latino community. We'll hear about a Hopkins conference that attempts to understand it better. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. 3 years ago, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake set a goal of bringing 10,000 more families to Baltimore within the next decade, a bold pledge in a city that saw a population decline by the thousands decade after decade. A key piece of the mayor's aspiration for the city is its appeal to immigrant families. 2 years ago, the mayor told members of Baltimore's Latino community that they are critical to meeting her goal of reversing the city's population decline and assured them that the city government would not discriminate against them. She issued an executive order that prohibits city employees from inquiring about immigration status. The order was issued after the federal government activated the Secure Communities Program here, the one that we were just discussing in the previous segment with Liz Alex from CASA de Maryland. While Latinos are still mostly concentrated in the southwestern United States, they continue to disperse across the country. Thousands of Latino immigrants, most of them Mexican, have settled in Baltimore in the last decade. Latinos are the fastest-growing ethnicity or race in the city, surging by more than 50% from 1990 to 2008, while Baltimore's population as a whole declined during that period, about 13%. Census data showed about 17,000 Latinos in the city by 2008, or 3% of the population. The latest census that I looked at puts the percentage at around 4.7%. and more than 8% for all of Maryland. In Baltimore, the number could be as high as 40,000 now, as many Latinos often go uncounted because of language barriers and immigration fears. An all-day conference at Johns Hopkins tomorrow looks at Baltimore's growing and changing Latino population and its needs. Here to tell us about it are Michael Hanchard, a professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University, and he co-directs the Racism, Immigration, and Citizenship Program there in the Political Science Department. Nice to have you with us, Michael.
Thanks a lot for the opportunity.
And Dr. Kathleen Page is with us, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Johns Hopkins and Coordinator of Latin American Studies at the Center for Global Health Education. In 2008, she established the Latino HIV Outreach Program with the City Health Department, an attempt to provide more care for Latinos living in Baltimore. So, Dr. Page, nice to have you with us, too.
Thank you very much, Dan.
There's so much in this program that you have slated for tomorrow, Michael Hanchard. Tell us a little bit about why. What brings it? Why is it happening now?
Yes, it's chock full of events. Part of the motivation for this conference came in part from my own early research on Brazil and working on racism, inequality, and political mobilization. And it was through that research I came to recognize the ways in which classification and categorization of national populations were really critical in getting rights and recognition for different peoples. since working on other parts of the world comparatively, it's become clear that this is a more general problematic for a range of different minority groups in different parts of the world, United States as well. Hmm. Now, in the United States, what's interesting is that historically, the United States has had what sociologists refer to as a bipolar model of race relations, white, black. And Latin America has been characterized as a place where you have societies where you have multipolar models. That is to say, on a chromatic continuum between white and black, there are all these other different colors on the rainbow. And that was led to assumptions, both popular and scholarly, that because of the fluidities of categories in Latin America, it meant at the same time that there was less discrimination and less inequality based on color and ethno-national distinctions. Hmm. Now, what's become clear, however, in research largely done by demographers but also other scholars over the past 20 years, is that the demographic data suggests that there are clear correlations between perceived skin color and social status, not just in the United States, but in Latin America as well. So one of the projects, Edward Tellis, who's a plenary speaker, he's coming in from Princeton. Yes. He has a project on ethnicity and race in Latin America, and he did an 18-country study, and what it demonstrated is what he calls pigmentocracy.
Pigmentocracy.
Wow. Right? So that there's this correlation between skin color and social status, so that lighter-skinned persons have significantly more education, have better employment chances, in many ways, marriage correlations have a lot to do with skin color and social status. So it's clear that if it's not characterized as race, but certainly color and phenotype, these are factors that contribute to classification. So one of the issues we're really going to try to get at the conference is think about this with respect to Baltimore and also just nationally, is what does the actual Latino population actually look like in Baltimore? And how does a shifting portrait of that population also then lead to different kinds of questions that scholars will both pose and try to answer as a result?
That's the name of this all-day conference, Shifting Portrait.
Shifting Portrait, right.
Yeah, Latinos, Public Health Inequality.
Right.
So you're looking at disparities, inequality. So you're looking at this emerging Hispanic Latino community in Baltimore, and it's not monolithic, obviously.
Right.
What does it look like? Meaning, where are the folks from? Dr. Page, let me ask you that question. In your experience at your clinic at Hopkins, I mean, what are you seeing? I mentioned that there are a lot of folks from Mexico. I think we know that already.
Yeah, so about here in Baltimore, what we're seeing is what we would call an emergent Latino population, and it's actually predominantly foreign-born. This is, of course, very different from other areas that have historically had a very established Latino population, like California or New York or even D.C.
Right.
And so here, when we've looked at this, about 50% of Latinos are of Mexican descent, and about 80% of all Latinos here in Baltimore are foreign-born. The rest, actually, are from Central America, primarily. So we have a bigger proportion of individuals from Central America than you would see in other areas of the country.
Which countries in particular do you see from Central America?
El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras. We're also starting to see quite a bit of immigration from Ecuador, which is not Central America, but from South America.
Mm-hmm. And is one of your concerns not only access to health, but disparities in health in terms of access to medical care?
Yeah, so we have major concerns in terms of access to health care in particular, and this is going to be discussed tomorrow. Latinos tend to be, the foreign-born Latinos often are undocumented, and they really have no easy access to insurance. And the Affordable Care Act is not really going to solve that problem for them. And so we have major issues in terms of just regular access to care. And then the other big part of it is access to linguistically and culturally competent care. So at Hopkins and really a lot of medical institutions are struggling with how to really provide care that makes sense and how to communicate with patients and how to meet the demand for interpretation services.
Your point about the Affordable Care Act, I had forgotten about this until I was doing some reporting at the Baltimore Sun on it. I think it was estimated that in Maryland, statewide, there was something like 800,000 people who had no health insurance. This is back, mm-hmm. now going back 4 years to when we were debating the Affordable Care Act. Once the law passed, only about half of those people really are eligible for Affordable Care Act. The rest are not eligible because of their immigration status.
Right.
This is a lot of people.
It's a lot of people, and it really creates a big conundrum because there are some programs that provide access. And so, for example, there is some access to federally qualified centers, but those are limited and they're bursting at their seams. And then what happens in places like Hopkins is that patients who come with an emergency situation, so they are having some sort of medical emergency, can get care. And that's, of course, highly costly and really not when you want to intervene in terms of healthcare. But access to preventive care, to really chronic health maintenance, is much, much more difficult.
Michael Hanchard, healthcare is one piece of this. What else are you looking at in this conference tomorrow?
Well, one of the things we're really interested in is sort of thinking about categorization, as I'd mentioned before, and the association. So if we think about inequality, whether it's related to public health or either other indices, doesn't begin in a clinic, doesn't begin at a doctor's office, but it begins in employment circumstances, educational, the interface between populations and other kinds of institutions that leads to certain stressors in daily life, which accumulate. And we want to get some sense, particularly since we're talking about really diverse populations, what's the internal variation in sort of thinking about and making sense of the relationship between the status of specific Latino populations and their overall health. But there are also some implications for researchers. So, putting on my fuddy-duddy scholarly cap, the epistemological implications. So in other words, how do we measure, how do we know Latinos when we see them? What's going to be the metrics? How do we measure and identify these populations, which becomes really, really, really critical in ways of sort of trying to make sense of how to provide more access to healthcare, but also other kinds of social services.
I'm not in the academy as you are, so I step out a bit and I say, no, this is what you're supposed to do. This is the role Hopkins is supposed to play in the community. You have an emerging population with that's changing. It's not only growing, it's changing, as Dr. Page was saying. It has needs that need to be assessed.
That's right.
And so everyone, civic leaders, elected leaders, all need to know what's coming down the pipeline. What I found interesting from some of my reading on this was that since the mayor put out this message that I described here in the beginning three years ago, first, that she wants to grow the city, and secondly, that that Baltimore will be welcoming to immigrants, because it's actually been a slow growth until recent years of the Latino community in Baltimore, that people have responded to that people have heard that. And I was just curious, Dr. Page, if you've heard anybody at all say, any patients you might have seen, anyone at all say, yeah, that's a good message. I heard that, or my uncle heard that, or my cousin heard that, and they're thinking about moving to Baltimore. Have you heard these stories at all?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of my favorite questions when I meet new patients is, how did you end up in Baltimore? Many of my patients, by the way, are immigrants. And often they tell me, many of them came here because someone else came here, but many of them have been in other areas of the country where they felt that the situation was not as friendly and were told by someone, usually a relative or a friend, that things were a little easier here.
Yeah.
So I think that in that sense, the word is spreading out and people, and it is attracting
you know,
Latinos.
We were just talking about the Secure Communities program, and Liz Alex cited a case where a man was stopped by a police officer in Baltimore County because he looked suspicious. That's the kind of thing I think we're all concerned about happening with this program. Maybe you want to speak to that. I don't know. Does some part of the conference speak to this tomorrow?
Well, yeah, we want to, because I think, one of the things, the great point you mentioned, which has a pretty profound comparative implication. So on the one hand, Baltimore population is declining in size, but the Hispanic Latino population is growing. And it's interesting you should mention the mayor's comments, because this has been a predicament not just here, but when we think about countries within the EU, Greece, Italy, France, have all had a range of different guest worker policies or policies to either subsidize or encourage immigration because of falling birth rates. And at the same time, you've had national political movements, often xenophobic, organizing against these people. So often you have, on one hand, an objective set of political and economic concerns, but on the other hand, you have these other kinds of highly normative, often xenophobic, xenophobic concerns. And I think that part of the reason why we want to stoke this conversation now is there's a way in which Hopkins as a community, we can get ahead of the curve. And in some sense, we can use examples from other cities across the country, but also cross-nationally to think about how they address these issues of population growth among specific minority populations.
Who is this conference for? Folks listening in our audience may be curious about whether they can attend.
Yes, good question. It's open to the public. Anyone can attend. We are really hoping to open and broaden a conversation and institutionalize a conversation at Hopkins, but institutionalize in a good sense. Hopkins.
This goes all day, and the program, you can find links to information about it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, Johns Hopkins University, a program of Latin American studies presenting Shifting Portrait, Latinos, Public Health, and Inequality. Could you tell us a little bit more about Edward Tellis? He is the your keynote speaker.
Yes.
He's from Princeton University. What will he be speaking about, and who is he? Just a little bit on him.
Well, Edward Tellis is one of the most significant sociologists and scholars of his time who works on ethno-racial categorization and classification in the Americas more generally, not just United States. And one of the advantages that he brings is that he's got a project, it's called the PERLA Project, P-E-R-L-A, that's the acronym, the Project on Ethnicity and Race in Latin America. And he's looked at and developed measures to look at the differences, for example, between how people identify themselves and how they're identified. So, for example, in an interview setting, if, for example, an interview says to a person, well, how would you classify yourself? A person might say, well, I'm café con leche, I'm a brown skin person, or I might consider myself white. And if the interviewer doesn't believe that, there's some discord. So right there, if we think about the cumulative effects, that means, for example, in a place like Brazil, there's often 30-point variances in the percentage of African-descended population in Brazil. And that has implications for social and political mobilization, for example. So, and he's done studies, longitudinal studies, on the racialization of Mexican-Americans in the city of Los Angeles. He's worked on projects of what he calls inclusionary discrimination in Latin America and the Caribbean. So he has a rich range of experiences, both as a scholar. He's helped inform policy. He also ran the Ford Foundation office in Rio de Janeiro for certain years and was also very influential and very active in helping develop discussion and implementation of affirmative action in Brazil.
Well, he kind of gets you started tomorrow morning.
Yes.
At 9:15, Edward Tellis from Princeton University, the dilemmas of ethno-racial classification among Latinos and Latin Americans. So who do you hope would take an interest in this?
Well, we hope actually, one of our hopes is that we'll get a broader conversation with community activists. So the last panel of the day is a community engagement panel. Elizabeth Alex, who we heard earlier, will be there from Casa de Maryland. Michael Scott from Equity Matters will be there. Catalina Rodriguez, the liaison to the mayor's office. And what we want, in some sense, is feedback from a range of different people. Say, well, look, if, you know, being on the ground, what's your sense of what you think Baltimore will look like 5 years from now from the perspective of a Latino?
Let me ask you that question, Dr. Page. What is your sense of that? If you were to answer that question in 5 years, do you see continued growth? Do you see it mostly from Central America, more coming from there?
Yeah, I mean, most likely there's probably going to continue to be immigration. But even if there weren't, there's going to be population growth in the Latino community just because of basic demographics and birth rates. And so one interesting thing that we've seen at Bayview is that, which is at the center of where a lot of the Latino community is that their pediatric practice is now 50% Latino and growing every day. And the same goes with the OB practice. Hmm. And so I think that's continuing to grow regardless of what happens in terms of immigration in or out.
There's so many implications there, even beyond health. I was just thinking about education, the public schools.
And in fact, you know, at Bayview, we have established a center for Latino health. It's called Centro Sol, in part to address these issues. And we are just starting a program for high schoolers. And we interviewed the high schoolers last week. And it was very interesting because about half of them had been born here. The other half had come here at different stages in life. And so, and they were some of them from the same family. So there's a lot of mixed families where kids are born in the U.S. and the other kids are not. And that, of course, creates a whole set of issues, again, beyond healthcare, really.
Do you have a perception of how Baltimore is doing in accepting and serving this growing community? I'm just thinking of language, for instance.
Yeah.
To young people out there thinking of careers in public health, for instance, or education, if you haven't picked up Spanish, maybe this is a good time.
So, yeah, this is what I'll say. So I am actually from South America originally, and I came to the States to study, and I went through pretty grueling 12 or even longer years of training. But right now, hands down, my most valuable skill is that I speak Spanish. And that's really how I've built my practice, my career.
Right.
I think the health systems are really, really struggling with trying to meet the demand. We don't have enough interpreters. And we don't even have signage in the hospitals. I mean, we are way lagging behind in trying to meet.
Speaks to what I said earlier about, you know, how Latinos have mostly been concentrated in the southwestern United States. And even though it's been in New York for a long time,
right.
Washington, D.C., Baltimore has kind of missed it until only recent years.
That's right. No, I was going to add just a very personal experience in this sense. I grew up in New York City, and Dan and Catherine, in this sense, I'm a child of immigrants. My parents were Jamaican. And I guess from a very early formative stage, what always interested me, particularly growing up in New York, I lived amongst Dominicans, Jamaicans, Puerto Ricans, Cubans, Italians, Eastern Europeans, and particularly amongst the people from the Caribbean. Many of us looked phenotypically, were identical to each other, but people classified themselves differently. So Dominicans tended not to to use a sort of Afro-descendant moniker. Puerto Ricans in New York City, at least, increasingly did by the 1970s, but it was in part because they were involved in certain political struggles connected to the civil rights movement. Jamaicans, as West Indians, sociologically fit somewhere in between.
Mm-hmm.
And so these kinds of things matter in daily life, how people classify themselves,
right.
And what are the contexts in which these things are important. So I think not just for the sort of scholarly or policy realm, but also in terms of everyday life, these things matter.
That's really interesting. Yeah. So you'll be addressing this tomorrow. Again, folks, this is a conference all day at Hopkins tomorrow at Mason Hall, starting at 8:30 in the morning, going all the way to 6 p.m., Shifting Portrait, Latinos, Public Health, Inequality. Find some information on it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Kathleen Page has been with us, Dr. Page from Johns Hopkins, assistant professor of medicine there and coordinator of Latin American Studies at the Center for Global Health Education. And Michael Hanchard has put this meal together for us as a professor of political science at Johns Hopkins and co-directs the Racism, Immigration, and Citizenship program there. Thank you both for being with us.
Thanks so much for your time.
We're going to take a little break here on midday. When we get back, it's all about rugby. Baltimore has a rugby team, and they're in their playoffs. We'll hear about that. I have some letters to read. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. This is Midday. The U.S. military secretly recruited hundreds of Nazi scientists and covered up their nefarious past to prepare for a Cold War Armageddon with the Soviets that never happened. Disturbing new details of Operation Paperclip, with stops at Edgewood and Frederick, Maryland, in the second hour of Midday after the news at 1. I wanted to catch up on some of our listener mail from this past week here on Midday. Let's see. We've got a couple of letters here off of our conversation the other day about suburban sprawl and the rebirth of urbanism. So let me read a couple of these. This is a pretty interesting. Here's one from Joy, who says, I just want to say that Bolton Hill has been a great place to raise our daughter in Baltimore City. When she was little, all the neighborhood children played together at Bolton Hill swim and tennis. When the pool closed at 9 in the summer, we would put their pajamas on. Everyone would walk home together. Then there is the swim team that the kids join until they graduate from high school. My daughter is a sophomore at the Baltimore School for the Arts. She walks to school, takes trains to D.C., takes the circulator bus as well as city buses and the light rail everywhere. She does her homework at different places like Barnes & Noble as well as the public library. I think, like your guest mentioned, that she is far more independent and confident and fearless than if we had raised her in the suburbs. Tim says this. He said, I enjoyed this conversation about suburbia versus urban life. I appreciate all the perspectives, but feel that there is a missing component. Freedom of choice and one's own personal preference is the great advantage of our American society. While there are great observations about advantages of living in the city or the suburbs, we should not pretend to decide for each other which is better. Having grown up in the city, I prefer to be able to live in the quiet woods and in a community that shares these preferences. Unlike the flavor of your discussion, I would not force my preference on others. So I was a little taken aback by that, because I don't know that we ever, you know, we're talking about forcing anything on anybody. We were talking about public planning of public spaces, making wise use of urban and suburban spaces, and discussing the trend of millennials in particular to move into cities or to choose to live there. I don't remember hearing anything about dictating where people should live, which is one is better than the other. Although our guest had the point of view that one is certainly better than the other, but he also said that suburban centers have their appeal as well. Jeffrey, who's writing to us from Cecil County, says, despite your guest's obvious affection for the city, there are still many people, including myself, who detest crowding, congestion, noise, and buildings. For many, city life is counterintuitive. Even suburbia is too much for me. I was born and raised in Mount Washington by the county line with a big yard and a big house. Many people desire the rural life of quiet, natural surroundings, fresh air, some wildlife and space. Being alone can be a very restorative and therapeutic lifestyle. Being alone or secluded does not mean being lonely. And let's not forget that without countryside, cities wouldn't exist. I guess you couldn't have anything to contrast it to, is his point. Our conversation about millennials. The other day, Dave says we have three generations living in one house, and most of the conflicts come between the youngest family members and the grandparents. The grandparents tend to believe that anything different from the 1950s is wrong and the country is going to the dogs. The 20-somethings get upset with their grandparents' intolerance. My wife and I stay out of it and get a good laugh. Let's see. I had an email here about Amy Chua on yesterday's show talking about the triple package, what leads to success and achievement among certain different ethnic cultural groups. Richard says, I believe what the authors are explaining is correct. Americans have lost the way to be successful, and the first thing we do is complain when we're not. Michelle says, I was really ready to disagree with Amy Chua based on my misconceptions about what this new book is about. However, I see that it's not really what I anticipated, that is, ethnocentrism, culture wars. I wonder if she had thought about a study based on the impacts that peer pressure and assimilation have on the eventual decline in the performance of certain immigrant groups coming to America, and that perhaps the isolation these groups may experience initially may push them to be more focused on what they consider markers of success, such as education. And Chip wrote in to say, about 2 years ago, a Muslim family moved into my neighborhood. I guess you'd have to see it, but their acceptance and subsequent assimilation into the fabric of the neighborhood represents a process that seems to fly in the face of your guest's assumption that as soon as immigrants arrive here, discrimination is automatically something they have to deal with. I hear these assumptions a lot more than I actually see them in practice. Midday on the Bay segment with Rona Cabell the other day, we talked about wildlife here in Baltimore City, particularly the yellow-crowned night heron, herons, plural, who are over there in the Jones Falls in North Baltimore and can be seen from a certain vantage near the old Steve Silver Company building. It's amazing. I walked over there the other day. Actually, it was yesterday morning. I saw eight of these herons. I saw three of their nests. There wasn't a big crowd there. It wasn't Disney World. Just very quietly walk up and take a look. It's pretty amazing. Before all the leaves come in on the trees, and you won't be able to see them maybe after that, but they're beautiful birds. Bruce wrote in to say, a friend who lived in Bolton Hill in the city used to see a red-tailed hawk in her yard. I know that in many cities, including New York, where they go after pigeons in Central Park, hawks take advantage of easy prey, such as rodents and smaller birds, as we crowd them out of their preferred habitat. So that's what I have for email, just to catch up there a little bit. Midday at WYPR.org. is our email address if you want to ever send in comments about the shows or suggest shows for the future. We welcome them. As you might have heard back on in November on midday, Baltimore has a rugby team and has had a rugby club for a good number of years. The Baltimore Chesapeake Brumbies, they're called. That's the city's entry in the Mid-Atlantic Rugby Football Union. And we had a couple members of the team and one of the assistant coaches, Dean Watakura, on the show back in November. He's a native New Zealander who moved here to Baltimore, lives in Federal Hill, and is assistant to the Brumbies head coach, Steve Elliott. And there's some kind of good news to share with you about the Brumbies. Brumby played for the Orioles. This is the Brumbies. Hello, Dean.
Hello, Dan. Kia ora, how are you?
Good.
Hello, listeners.
Dean Watakura. So things have been going well, and actually the Brumbies are in the playoffs, right?
Correct. We've been sneaking under the radar, Dan, and somehow we found ourselves in the playoffs.
Well, I haven't been paying attention, I must say. I lost track of you guys. I'm so glad I heard from you again. You had one season in the summer and fall, and then a second, like a winter-spring season, right?
Sort of. It's a little bit strange to me. Coming from New Zealand, our season goes straight through, but unfortunately, because of weather, they have to split the season here. So it's actually one season, but it takes place over the fall, and then it finishes in the spring.
Okay.
So we're coming to the finish now.
So how has the team been doing? I guess the team's been doing pretty well if it's in the semifinals.
Yeah, we're not doing too bad there, Dan.
I'm glad to hear it.
You know, it's been a long learning experience for the boys. I can't tell you how hard they've worked. It's been wonderful watching them progress, you know, in their skills, and it's been great for them to be able to get this. It's been a very difficult road, a lot for them to learn, and they've done it well.
Well, that's good. And what you noticed among the men is an eagerness to learn from someone who's actually, this is a national sport. This is the native sport of New Zealand.
Sure. I think that's the same no matter where you go with rugby clubs, Dan. There's just something about the boys that decide to go and play rugby. It's more like a family than anything, and they really, they really become a part of the culture. So it's nothing different. The eagerness is nothing different. I think more than anything, it's the commitment that when they're on the pitch, you know, there's nothing like the American psyche, not even in New Zealand, irrespective of how well we play or how long we've been playing for. There's just something about your competitive spirit that really makes rugby special here, especially the type of rugby that we play. We play differently to anybody else, and you can see that as the year has progressed, our boys have gotten better and better at our match plan. It's totally different to anybody has seen here in America, and I think it's doing us really well. I think we're going to cause some surprises at the playoffs, and hopefully we can take a little bit further to the Nationals. We'll make people sit up and listen and say, what are they doing over there in Baltimore?
So tell us just a little bit about how this works, Dean. I know you play in a league here, the Mid-Atlantic Rugby Football Union. I know you travel a bit. You play a team from Potomac area. You play, I believe, in North Carolina too, right?
Mm. We play as far down as, I think our furthest away game is actually Raleigh in North Carolina.
Okay.
And also we play as far north, I believe, as either Schuylkill or Schuylkill. River or
that's right.
Pittsburgh Harlequins. I'm not sure.
Right.
I don't know.
And then you play. But then tomorrow. So tomorrow you're in Wilmington, Delaware for the first for the semifinal game.
Mm, correct. The Mafu semifinals and the final are played over this weekend. So we have a match against Potomac Athletics Club. And then at the same time, there will be another match being played between the other two participants in the final four.
Okay.
That's Norfolk and Schuylkill. And the winner of those two matches goes to the final on Sunday.
Well, very
and
good.
And hopefully, if we come through, we'll be heading off to, I believe it's Pittsburgh, for the national playoffs.
That's excellent. I'm glad to hear it, Dean. So we wish you good luck. Thanks for being on the show so I could wish you good luck. And
Thank you so much, Dan.
Yeah, do the haka for me, will you? Okay.
Well, if we win, there'll be plenty of haka.
Excellent. That's Dean Wadakura, assistant coach to Steve Elliott of the Baltimore Chesapeake Brumbies in the Mid-Atlantic playoff tomorrow, 4 o'clock. You can find information about the rugby club on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. All right, that's the Midday Friday first hour. We close down now to take a slice of pizza from Joe Squared Pizza, and then we'll be back for the second hour of our show.